making a preliminary investigation or experience of Bademar, which we'll be looking into much more closely in the next 3 days. Let me first of all just say something about the form of these presentations. I call them rambles. I think this is the third of my set of rambles at the LBC. And it's a sort of a form of presentation that I find particularly enjoyable, although slightly dangerous, because I don't altogether know where I'm going to go. I've got a theme, and I have sort of got a preliminary path into the countryside, but I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to get deeper into it and where I'm going to go. I'm rather notorious as a walker. I don't know if there's anybody here who's been walking with me, but I'm rather notorious because often our Dhamma dinner is looking blanching in the background there. It's rather notorious. If you go for a walk with Subhuti, you may end up in a bramble patch or in a bog. So I can't promise that we'll find, you know, the heights and look at vast vistas. But anyway, we'll just sort of set off across the countryside and see where we get to. I hope there'll be not only be about pleasure, amongst other things, but be, to some extent, pleasurable. So I will talk. Sometimes I may not even be that clear about what I'm talking about myself. In fact, quite a lot of the time I may not be. But I'm quite open to questioning as I go along. So if you find that you just don't know really what I'm talking about, or it seems that something to you is begged, a question is begged, then ask it. However, please forgive me if I don't take the proffered bait. It may be that I'm just not able to go there, if you see what I mean. Because I'm sort of going somewhere, and it may be quite convenient to me to follow the lead that you give me. It may be that I just can't think about it, if you see what I mean. So I hope we can work together in a way that keeps you engaged and enables me to go into what I think is an extremely important topic. I don't think that what I'm going to say is revolutionary, but I hope that I can make some connections that are a little fresh, but they may take some time to come out. Yes, I'm going to be exploring a theme that I've been reflecting on and introspecting on quite a bit for the last few months. It's not just to do with pleasure, it's also to do with pain, I'm sorry to say. But I want to sort of share some of these reflections and some things that I found in the Buddha's own words in the Pali Canon that shed further light on what's happening. I think that pleasure is, well, something extremely important to us. We like pleasure, I hope. It's a bit strange if we don't. And on the other hand, of course, if you like pain, then that suggests that pain is pleasurable to you, but we won't get into those sort of issues. So pleasure is very, very significant to us as human beings. And it's a basis, really, for valuing in the Dhamma. That's what I want to explore, the way in which pleasure is a key to value, or a clue to value. It's the basis, for instance, I think, of Buddhist aesthetics. I think if I can bring out what the Dhamma has to say about pleasure, it'll teach us something about Buddhist aesthetics and show us how Buddhism evaluates aesthetic experience. And it's, in the end, to understand the place of pleasure in spiritual life is a determinant of the kind of life that we lead. If we understand the place that pleasure has, it enables us more clearly to decide how to live our lives. I hope that will come out in the course of these days. Maybe not today, maybe tomorrow or the next day. I hope we'll begin to look at how we relate to pleasure in such a way that it aids our spiritual life rather than hinders it. The first thing I should say is that from a Buddhist point of view, pleasure, happiness, satisfaction, using all those terms as roughly synonymous, maybe looking at different modalities of pleasure. Pleasure, happiness, satisfaction are not goals. Pleasure is not a goal in the Dhamma. We're not living the spiritual life so that we can have pleasure. At the same time, it's very difficult to live without pleasure, and in some form or other, without physical pleasure, without mental happiness, without a sense of satisfaction. It's very difficult indeed, and very difficult to pursue spiritual practice unless we're getting some reward in the form of pleasure on some level or other. Some satisfaction at the very least needs to come to us from what we're doing. So it's not a goal, but it's something that's vital to the process of leading the spiritual life. In Buddhism, the goal, of course, is Buddhahood. And Buddhahood, of course, is always not just about yourself, because to be a Buddha is to carry out a sort of cosmic function. A Buddha is one who discovers the path to enlightenment and realizes that path, and then transmits it to others, and then classically takes rebirth in a situation where that path can be opened up to others who have no access to it. So that the goal is not just a personal one in Buddhism, by definition. This is not often sort of drawn out. The fact that Buddhahood as a goal is a transpersonal goal, a transpersonal end. So that's what we're pursuing. We're pursuing that goal through our Buddhist practice. But the pursuit of that goal will be accompanied by an increasing experience of happiness, of satisfaction, and even at times of pleasure, in the more immediate sense. So this is the way that the two fit together in Buddhism. We're not aiming at it, but it will be there, and it'll be there to a deeper and stronger degree, the greater the progress that we make. So we need to get that relationship quite clear in our minds. Ultimately, of course, gaining that goal is the gaining of unimaginable bliss, so it's said. Not bliss in any sense that we can really comprehend. It's not a great physical pleasure, as it were. It's not even the happiness of, you know, getting a prize in the lottery or something like that. It's a deep, deep sense of relaxation, of ease, of peace, of contentment, and of happiness. But of a degree that is beyond our present understanding and experience. So that the goal is a pleasurable one. It's supremely pleasurable. And it's not just pleasurable momentarily, it's enduringly pleasurable. Part of the happiness of enlightenment is that you know you cannot lose it. You know it cannot be disturbed. So there's no sense of insecurity. Most of our pleasures, most of our happiness, has a background of insecurity. We know that it's based upon conditions, and once we know that those conditions can change. And so we have a background, a residual sense of dis-ease, even in our moments of greatest happiness and pleasure. But the pleasure of enlightenment has no such insecurity, because you know through direct experience that you cannot lose it. Again, I just want to make sure that this is clear at the outset of our exploration. We're not talking about pursuing pleasure, but what we're talking about is making sure that pleasure is a factor in our lives, and that we work with pleasure in a way that is constructive and that leads us to the ultimate goal of the Dharma. So far, so good? No disagreement so far? Okay, the way seems to be fairly clear so far. We're only just getting into the foothills. Yes, but Buddhism is not about experience, in the sense it's not, the Dhamma life is not lived in order to have experiences. Lots of experiences will come to you, well, you can't but experience, can you? But all sorts of interesting experiences will come as a result of your spiritual practice. You will, from time to time, experience in meditation what are known as samapatti. Some of those will be intensely blissful. Some of them will be very, very engaging, very interesting, or something more than interesting, enthralling. Those will come. But they're not what you're living the Dhamma life for. They're an inevitable accompaniment of it, but they're not what you're leading it for. You're not leading the Dhamma life for experiences. You're leading the Dhamma life in order to recognise the nature of all experience, so that you recognise in whatever experience comes to you the same underlying reality, the same truth. And the recognition of that same underlying reality frees you. It frees you from the pain of insecurity, the suffering of isolation, and so on, and gives you this unimaginable sense of ease and satisfaction, even bliss. So, yes, we're not pursuing experiences. I just read a very interesting paper by Sangharakshita. Some of you might be interested to look up. It's called Hedonism and the Spiritual Life. It's a book review which Nagabodhi published in Alternative Traditions, a book by, again, Sangharakshita, which consists mainly of book reviews. And it's a review of a book by a Hindu writer, I think it was a German originally, in America. And it's talking about, the book is talking about mysticism. And what he's talking about is mysticism as the pursuit of, I think he calls it the zero experience. The experience of intense union with something beyond yourself. And Sangharakshita's critique of this approach is that it's only dealing with experience, and those experiences come, those experiences go, and there's no sense of self-transformation. You can have the most wonderful experiences and just be the same person afterwards when they go. As anybody who's done any meditation knows, you can be deeply, deeply absorbed in meditation. You can be experiencing the strongest of Maitri and lose your rag within a few minutes of it ending. Or just lose your mindfulness within a few minutes of it ending. We're not trying to pursue experience. So Sangharakshita says that the difference between Buddhism and this approach to mysticism is that in Buddhism, we are pursuing the spiritual life for the sake of a deep understanding of the nature of things, a complete recognition of the true nature of things, which then frees us from the turbulence of life. So yes, please be clear about this. We're not talking about pleasure in order to whip ourselves up into a frenzy of bliss, nice as that might be. It's worth a go, but sorry, don't have those skills. I'll leave that to Maitreya Bandhu, who's able to do that, I'm sure. But we are trying to pursue an understanding of the true nature of things, and that will be accompanied by an increasing experience of pleasure, an increasing understanding of the nature of pain and transcendence of it. So let's keep this in mind. We're not pursuing happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness may be the goals of the American Constitution, but in our case, it's the pursuit of, as Buddhists, it's the pursuit of understanding of the true nature of things, and that will give us true happiness. Okay. Gosh, that went rather quickly, that stage of the... This is the problem with this. I may even just expound the whole thing in one day, and that'll be that. So please, somebody get some problems soon. Okay, let's then just ground ourselves in tradition. What are the traditional terms that we're dealing with? What has the Buddha got to say about the question of pleasure and pain and so on? So the original term for pleasure is sukha vedana. Sukha, it's not just pleasure in the physical sense, but it includes a deep mental satisfaction, or even a moderately superficial mental satisfaction. So it covers the whole gamut from pleasure to happiness, even to bliss. Vedana is a word we'll need to go into in a bit, but it's usually translated as feeling, perhaps rather inadequately. Dukkha is the term for pain. And dukkha is, again, it extends from immediate physical pain through to unhappiness, insecurity, and so on. So the basic terms we're going to be looking at are sukha vedana, dukkha vedana. There's a third term, which is neutral feeling, usually translated as, or sometimes it's said to be neither painful nor pleasant. So na sukha, na dukkha. But often it's described by the word upekkha in Pali, upeksha in Sanskrit, which is sometimes translated as neutral feeling. But it doesn't really mean neutral. That's not quite an adequate translation. It's so low in affect that it doesn't register, if you see what I mean. It doesn't have enough kick to it to register in your mind. That's a quite complex term. It has a very rich meaning, extending from a mere dullness, a lack of engagement, which leads you to have no particular feeling. It's a sort of dullness, a boredom, and that sort of thing. But it leads all, at its highest reaches, it means a state of complete equipoise, of being so sort of above it all, so contented that nothing disturbs you. So it's a highly positive state in its deepest meaning. But at its sort of more immediate meaning, it refers to a state of hedonic neutrality. Nothing's really getting you going. It doesn't turn you on in any sense of turn, or turn you off. Sukha, dukkha, upekkha, vedana. Vedana, as I say, is usually translated as feeling. But in English, English doesn't provide us with precise enough terms for this whole area. So when we say feeling, sometimes we mean mere sensation. Sometimes we mean something more approaching emotion. I feel like hitting you. To take a negative one, I feel like kissing you. That's another one. So those are clearly our something more than merely an affect. They are an emotion. So the word feeling in English just doesn't really have enough precision to it. It's interesting that in modern Indian languages, Vedana has slipped into a more general meaning. But in original Buddhist languages, in Pali and Buddhist Sanskrit, it's got a very, very tight meaning. What it means is something like hedonic, hedonic physical and mental sensation. Hedonic meaning the pleasure pain dimension. So it's sensation insofar as it's immediately felt, experienced, but it's hedonically tinged. It's tinged with pleasure, pain, or nothing in particular. Is that clear enough? You've probably got that a little bit. I think it becomes clearer when you're meditating, because the mind is calmer, and you're not so quickly moving into emotion. Sensation. It's the hedonic tinge to sensation, and by sensation I mean not merely sensation in the body, but sensation, as it were, in the mind. We'll be going into a lot of this more later on, so don't worry if it's not precisely clear now. It's one of those sort of ranging shots where one can sort of get a broad idea of what's being talked of, and as we go on we'll get clearer. So, yes, what we're looking at is that aspect of our experience, of our total experience, which is mental and physical sensations, hedonic tinge, hedonic colour, you might say. It gets clearer still when we look at that in terms of the basic Buddhist analysis of experience. I imagine that most of you are familiar with these sort of ways of looking at things. You're familiar with the five skandhas, or the five khandhas. So the five skandhas are rupa, vedana, samnya, samskara, and vijnana. We're looking at, you know, this situation. Here we are. We're sitting here. We're experiencing, all of us, every one of us, we're experiencing. If you're not, then you're not listening. You're not able to listen. So you're experiencing right now. Now there's a dimension of your experience which is, so to speak, objective. It lies outside your mind. It appears, at least, to lie outside your mind. We're not going to get too philosophical about that. Schopenhauerians, quieten down. So it's what presents itself as objective to your experience, the objective dimension of the experiencing situation, it's been said, described as. So it's the object of your eye, the sound that you're hearing, the smell that touches your nose, the touch sensation that your body elicits. What have I missed? Oh, taste. The taste that you have on your tongue. So it's what those appear to be referring to leave it philosophically neutral. So that's rupa. Every experiencing moment has an apparent objective dimension. In a dream, there's an apparent objective dimension. When you're in the dream, there's a world that appears to be out there. That's rupa. So it's not a materialist conception, if you see what I mean. It's not, rupa is not talking about the real world independent of you. It's saying that in the experiencing moment, whatever that moment is, whatever substances you've imbibed, there will be an element that appears as out there. That's rupa. Form, it's sometimes translated as. So then have I done sparsha, fasa? No, I didn't do sparsha. Oh, wait a minute, that's a different analysis. You see what I mean? We're getting into the brambles already. The objective dimension of experience comes into contact with the senses. So it's not merely that we're not treating them as something that exists independently of the experiencing moment. We're saying that in the experiencing moment, there is an objective dimension that is experienced. So that experience of the objective dimension gives rise to vedana. It gives rise to an hedonic tinge. When you perceive certain things, they give rise to pleasant sensations. When you perceive other things, they give rise to painful sensations. This is complex, the way in which this arises, and we'll be going into that more in a while. But for the moment, we're doing an analysis of the total experiencing situation. It's what presents itself as objective to us, which gives rise to feelings of pleasure and pain within us, or just a neutrality. We then interpret that experience. We fit it into an interpretive framework, which is based upon our memories in the past, the labels that we've learned to apply to things, and which shapes the objective component of the situation into a total assembled experience, if you see what I mean. You know, visual images are hitting the eye, immediately those give rise to some sensations. Then your mind gets to work to create from that a picture of sitting here in the shrine room at the LBC listening to Subhuti rambling. So you work all the data up into an assembled picture. That, of course, itself actually gives rise to new Vedanas, but we won't go there yet.
And that sparsha, what are you describing? Which are the...
So we're using this, the five skandhas. The five skandhas incorporate sparsha under rupa, if you see what I mean. So in the five skandha system, the sparsha has already taken place. So what you're experiencing is rupa, is the product of sparsha. I think we need to finish the whole thing and come back.
But I just thought you would give it a label, but it's still Vedana you're talking about. When you're talking about interpreting the sense.
Yes, yeah.
It's still Vedana.
Yes, yeah. No. I'm sorry, I see what you're getting at. Samnya. Samnya. The interpretive function is samnya. It's like the filter that you put upon your experience to form it into a pattern. It's interpretation, samnya, or sanya. In Pali. So we've got rupa, which is the objective dimension of experience. We've got vedana, which is the hedonic response to experience. We've got samnya, which is the forming of the data of experience into a pattern, which will have recognized objects within it, and so on. And will be related to previous experience. So yes, samnya. Thank you. You got there in the end, didn't you? Yeah, you had to push me a bit. So then, what's next? Sanskara. So there's a response to experience, especially once you've interpreted your experience. There's an impulsion to act, an impulsion to move in relation to it, volition. From the total assemblage of experience comes a volition. And of course that's a whole other complex area. That's samskara, sankara, or it's karma, or chetana. We'll be looking at karma later, so we can relate back to this term. All of this is contained within a field of awareness, of vijnana. Vijnana is, so to speak, the containing framework within which all this takes place, consciousness, awareness. So in every moment of consciousness, we can identify these elements, at least in a primitive way. Actually, they're assembled in a very, very complex way. But first of all, there's that which is apparently objective to us, that presents itself to us as data. There's the immediate responses that we have to that in terms of hedonic response, pleasant or painful. There's the interpretation of that, which is samnya. There's the response to it in terms of volition, which is sankara. And surrounding it all, so to speak, is the moment of awareness, which assembles it all into the complex of experience. So, is that clear so far? Yeah, it's all perhaps familiar territory, but I'm going over it so that we can locate Vedana quite clearly. Pause for a moment. Anybody puzzled, bored, frustrated, fascinated? Okay, too normal. There's another system, by the way, which is we're also familiar with in FWBO, which comes from another Abhidharma, which talks of fasa or sparsha instead of rupa, contact. Otherwise, it's more or less the same, although it replaces vijnana with manasakara, the mind-making, as it were, the act of attention which brings all of this together into a moment of experience. Okay, so Vedana is that component of the total complex of experience which is hedonic response, pleasant, painful or neutral. And the interesting thing is that the samskaras and the omnipresent mental events, they're omnipresent. Every moment has those five components in it. So Vedana is there all the time. There's never an absence of Vedana. There may be a Vedana that's so sort of weak or so attenuated that we hardly experience it. But there's some hedonic response all the time. Even when we feel completely bored, not interested, there's still a hedonic component, but it's very, very weak. That's what upeksha means. It means a hedonic tone that is so dilute that you almost can't identify it. But Vedana is always present in our experience. So it's clearly very, very important that we know what to do with it, that we know how to use it. So that's one traditional analysis that locates Vedana quite clearly.
I'm just wondering about, you talk about moments of awareness or momentary experiences, and I don't know how to put that together with omnipresent mental events, like Vedana always being there.
Yes. It's the category is omnipresent, not any particular element, if you see what I mean. It's a bit like the problem that comes when you say, but isn't impermanence permanent? You know what I mean? It's very difficult to get out of that when somebody gets stuck in it. So yes, there's always some kind of Vedana present, but it's always a new arising of Vedana. Do you see what I mean? So it's not that Vedana is one thing that's there all the time. It's that Vedana is actually a stream of moments of hedonic response. This is it's good to fall into that trap because it's one that's very easy to do. You can impute a permanence just by giving a label to something.
So Rupa and Vedana are not under conscious control. When we're working on our... Am I jumping ahead and thinking where our spiritual work goes?
Yeah.
Is it in the vinyanas?
Yeah, you're jumping ahead, but you're jumping ahead rightly.
Okay.
And I'm willing to follow you there.
Right.
This time. So the second analysis that we need to apply to Vedana is the 12 Nidanas. Again, probably familiar to you. Can anybody write here? Would somebody like to write the 12 Nidanas round in a circle? Yes, an artist to write them down. You don't have to write them too beautifully. So yeah, we've got avidya or ignorance. And we've got then sankara or sankara, which is volitional tendencies. I'm sorry?
So I haven't quite got how these connect with the skandhas. This is in relation then to the Vedana.
It's another analytic system which... It's a dynamic analytic system, where the samskaras are a sort of static one. So the samskaras are a bit like taking a loaf of bread and slicing it through and seeing what's on the surface of the slice. The skandhas are like the slicing through the loaf of bread. The nidanas are like... they're like watching the process of a loaf of bread being cooked, if you see what I mean. So at any moment, all the skandhas are present, but they come into being in a dynamic interplay, which is what we're going to look at in these nidanas. Yeah. Sankara. K-H-A-R-A. Yeah. We'll write them down in Pali and then, because otherwise it'll take a long time. Then vijnana. Nama rupa. Salayatana. Sal, I, Atana. Salayatana. S-A-L-A-Y-A-T-A-N-A. Phasa, P-H-A-S-A.
Sorry, what's that?
P-H-A-S-A. And Vedana. Okay, so you can pause for a moment. So this analysis shows us how Vedana comes into being. And it starts with avidya, which means our fundamental ignorance about the way things are. It's a very large issue, and I'm going to hasten over it. So, as a result of Vedana, we act. We're driven to act in the world. That's sankhara, is the volitional drive that leads to our actions. That then leads to a moment of consciousness. So the analysis is becoming more minute. It leads to a moment of consciousness, a moment of vijnana. That moment of vijnana forms into a psychic whole, a sense of subject and object, a sense of in here, out there, of body and mind, nama rupa. In other words, the five skandhas. The five skandhas contain the six sense spheres. Salayatana means six sense spheres. And those come in contact with the external world. Through that contact with the external world, sparsha, Vedana arises. So, this isn't quite working, is it?
What's the sutra?
The which, sorry?
Is that the correct spelling?
Fasa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, sparsha is the Sanskrit. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't understand what you're doing now with all this. Are you talking about another possible construct of our experience, or are you...
Well, it's what I said already, that with the skandhas, you're analysing the experience right now. With the nidanas, you're analysing the way in which experience unfolds dynamically. Got it?
So they're two parallel systems?
You could say that.
The bread analogy, I didn't understand.
Okay,
so,
yeah. But yeah, they're two parallel systems. It's okay, but there are two parallel systems, that'll do. There are two parallel analyses. One analysis which is to do with a moment of experience. The other analysis is which is to do with a sequence of moments of experience.
What brings it down even more discreetly?
No, it shows how they unfold dynamically. So that you could say that one is a spatial analysis. It's analysing now within a moment of time, as it were, conceived spatially. Yes, and the other one is a temporal analysis, which analyses in terms of unfolding within time. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't make clear that I was doing two different things. Yeah. Yes. So. Ignorance, volitional formations, it's usually translated as, not a very elegant way. Vijnana, consciousness. Nama rupa, name and form, which really means mind and body. Salayatana means six sense spheres. Fasa means contact. Vedana means, what was it, the hedonic, physical and mental sensation. Yeah. You know what it means.
I'm sorry, you said that this, that the Nidanas, or how Vedana comes into being.
Yes.
And I think that the explanation sprung from this crucial question as to whether we are able to change our Vedana.
Ha. Yeah, we're getting there. It's going to take a while. It's going to take a while. Yeah, no, I'm sorry, it's not that simple. I've got to go on tomorrow, you see, so I've got to... I'm sorry, I haven't put this out very well. I've stumbled into it. In a way, I'm more locating for those who know this system, but I hope we'll be able to expose it to those who don't. So the Nidana chain is conceived of both momentarily, as it were, within this life, is also conceived of as a movement from one life to another. So it's against the background of the traditional Buddhist belief in again becoming. So what's being said is that your overall failure to understand the real nature of things leads to you acting, and the actions that you take based on your failure to understand the real nature of things leads to a renewed birth. It leads to a renewed arising of consciousness. That renewed rising of consciousness unfolds into an experience of body and mind, of subject and object. That experience of subject and object leads to a contact of specific moments leads to the sense organs coming into contact with the objects of experience. That leads to Vedana. So what this illustrates is the fact that Vedanas happen to you as the result of things that you've set up in the past. Do you see what I mean? So that the Vedanas that you experience now are not what you choose to have right now. Of course you can, to some extent. You can choose to eat a piece of chocolate. But the overall capacity to enjoy chocolate and the sensations that come to you as a result of your body have already been predetermined by the taking up of the body. So, I feel like I've stumbled into this in a clumsy way. I could do with a Nidana, what do you call it, a wheel of life here. Or is everybody all right? Somebody say reassuringly, I'm all right. Yeah, really, the main point is that Vedanas happen to you. You don't choose them. Sorry about all that. They come to you, as it were, without your immediate choice. You don't have an immediate choice over whether somebody punching you hurts you or not. You know, when somebody hits you, the nerve endings are squashed, or whatever happens to be non-physiological about it, and a message goes to the brain which says ow. And you can't immediately decide, no, I think I'll find that pleasurable. It's the result of your previously established dynamic that sensation presents itself to you in the way that it does. So here we're talking about the distinction between karma and vipaka. Karma means action, vipaka means fruit. So all our experience is distributed under the heading of either karma, what we do, or vipaka, what we experience, what happens to us. So within the skandhas, back to the skandha system, there are elements that are volitional, which we have some control over, and elements that are the fruit of our past action. So, rupa is a resultant. It happens. When you look in that direction, you see what your eye presents to you. Vedana is a resultant. Samnya is a bit mixed. It's a bit more complex. The interpretation you have some flexibility with, and we'll be looking at that a bit later in relation to Vedana. But interpretation is to some extent given. It's given by the kind of organism that you are. It's given by your culture, even. But you have some degree of personal choice about it, some degree of flexibility about it. You can more immediately change the interpretation that you have. So a samnya is sort of somewhere between vipaka and karma. Samskara, chetana karma, is obviously the primary karmic element, the volition, the decision that you make to act, the motivation that you have. And then consciousness. Consciousness arises in dependence on the previous moment of consciousness. So it's non-volitional. You can, from that point, make another moment of consciousness arise. So the primary vipakic elements are the sensations, the objective element, and the hedonic response. Those happen to us by and large, although in a somewhat complex way, as we'll see in a while. So that's the payload of this. In the previous life, the ignorance and samskara are volitional. They are karmas. Everything that happens from there on is the result. So, it's not that every brick that falls on your head is the result directly of a particular action that you've performed. But it is the result of your having performed actions that have established for you a human body. And a human body is one which occupies a world where bricks fall on heads, if you see what I mean. So that it's the karma vipaka in the sense that it's the result of having performed actions that lead to a human existence. So it's a bit like, you're born in England and you have to put up with the weather, if you see what I mean. You don't have to be born in England, you could be born somewhere else, and you can even travel somewhere else, but if you're in England, you have to put up with the weather. If you go to Benidorm, you have to put up with the Benidorm belly, if you see what I mean. Do you know what I mean? You don't actually choose the weather when you're born into England, but it is part of the package. The pleasure, pain, and the neutral sensation, Vedana, are the result of previous actions. They come to you because of what you've done before. That's complex. Some of them are the result, as I've said, of sort of the package deal of a human body. Some of them are much more immediate. If you choose to speak in a certain way, somebody will say something unpleasant back to you. If you choose to speak in another way, somebody will say something pleasant to you. You can even also change your Vedana by a shift in your mental attitude. You can see that with a person. You see it with a Maitri Bhavana, for instance, that a certain person coming into your mind causes you an unpleasant sensation. It's painful to think of that person. But by developing Maitri, even within a single session of meditation, you can change that to having a quite pleasant experience of thinking of that person. So there's a physical dimension to Vedana, and there's a mental dimension to Vedana. some Vedanas are mainly physical, some Vedanas are mainly mental. So a punch to the arm, as I've said, fires off nerve signals to the brain, which are immediately painful. In this sense, your interpretation of it has very little effect. It's an immediate sensation of pain. And the same goes for pleasures. But as the mind begins to interpret the world around it, it forms the pleasures and pains that we have to a much stronger extent. So that, think of an example. Anybody think of an example? Somebody mentioned something the other day, that there's an old children's game where you have to put your hand inside a bag and identify something. So, you know, they peel a grape and put it inside the bag, and you feel it, and, you know, somebody says, oh, it's an eyeball. And you go, ah! You know, you immediately react to it. And then they say, no, it's a peeled grape. And you feel quite differently about it. So that your interpretation shapes that your hedonic response. You should get everybody to play that game right now. So there are some sensations that, some Vedanas are very strongly determined by your interpretation. Some Vedanas, that the interpretation plays a much, much lower role in. Obviously you have much more control over those that are more mental, which is what you're doing in meditation. You're able to change the way you feel, the way you respond, by changing your attitude, so to speak. So Vedana covers the whole range from immediate physical sensation, which is primarily painful or pleasant, primarily in the sense of immediately so, through to much more complex mental interpretations, which have subtle shifts of pleasure and pain, and give rise to subtle shifts of pleasure and pain. So the more mental the more mental pleasures and pains are more malleable, they're more flexible. You can change them by changing your attitude to them. It's much more difficult to change your attitude to an immediate physical sensation. You can do it. I remember when I was losing my teeth. Do you remember the exquisite sensation of pain as you wiggle a loose tooth? And you wiggle it, and it's painful, but you can sort of somehow make it pleasurable. Or am I particularly revealing my attitude? Oh dear, I've given the game away. But it's odd that the sensation which you your first take on it is that it's painful, but as you sort of wiggle away, I spent many hours in classrooms sort of wiggling my teeth. It can strangely become pleasurable. So you can even work on immediate sensation. So it's said traditionally, though, that the sense of touch is the only one that gives you primary pleasure and pain. All the other sense media give you that primary pleasure and pain mixed with mental interpretation, if you see what I mean. So, for instance, a visual image gives you pleasure. You see something that's pleasurable, but there's no sort of immediate tactile sensation. The pleasure comes from the way in which you look at it, the interpretive structure that you give to it. So, for instance, if it's you see somebody coming towards you and you think it's a friend, well, you feel a sensation of pleasure. And then you suddenly realise, no, it's my worst enemy, who looks very much, is the twin of my best friend. And you immediately have a sensation of displeasure. So the more immediately tactile, the more direct the sensation of pleasure and pain is. And the more mental it is, the more mediated, the more malleable it is. Please.
What are you using when you're modifying your reactions to things? Are you using your vijnana, or is that another construct
Well, it would be. Trying to use the construct
sure.
that you've given.
It'd be primarily samya.
So you're using samya.
You're reinterpreting the experience,
right.
Which is in a sense what you're doing when you're meditating. You're trying to reconfigure your experience. So, for instance, when you move from the beginning of mindfulness of breathing, you have one samya of the experience, one interpretation of the experience, which is very much, in my mind, bound up with a sort of mental image of yourself breathing. And as you progress in the practice, you try to move away from the constructed self-image to a more immediate experience of the sensations. So there's a shift in samya. I think a lot of meditation is aided by recognizing that what you're doing is trying to alter the interpretive structure that you're imposing. Mm.
I wondered if you wanted to say anything, or were able to say anything, about how this connects with the kind of flight and fight. So the way that sort of Western psychology, because this being our feelings, in a sense, and has been created in humans as a sort of safety mechanism.
Right.
Possibly.
Yeah.
In the sense that there are some things that you run away from.
Yeah.
And some things that you move towards. So I was interested, you were talking about touch. I would imagine that there was some fairly primal.
Well, you could certainly interpret the whole thing in that way. Yes, it's clearly very physical, and it's to do with our body as an animal reality. Yes.
So. But in a sense, that also fits anyway into the whole Nidana schema, because it's way back from our past life, when we were together and we had to escape things.
Mm.
So that small element that of which we have no immediate choice,
mm-hmm.
you could potentially see as being those things that were, you know, dangerous to us.
Well, the problem is that, of course, the instincts are not necessarily wise.
Indeed.
So our instinctual responses are inefficient for survival.
Absolutely.
I mean, for instance, you know, we have a sensation of pleasure at sugary things, which means we go on eating them until we get diabetes. Whereas, you know, presumably the mechanism that led sugar to be the selected sugar was because... we needed it when we were short, you know, we had periods of scarcity and so on. So, you could say that these sensations, you could look at these sensations from a certain point of view as the results of an biological evolution. But there's a dimension to us that is capable of transcending that biological evolution. And so that's why, in a way, we need to become more aware of Vedana. And not let it dominate and drive us, not make us react, as we'll see. Yeah, so it's a useful angle to bring into it. Does that connect up?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. So go back to the meditation point, because I think that's quite an interesting one, although it's not immediately to do with Vedana. It just shows how samya works, that when you sit to meditate, you try to drop the interpretation of the world that you normally function within. You try to withdraw into a much more immediate experience of the sensations that, for instance, make up breathing. So you'll often find that you can notice that shift taking place, which is really the shift from access concentration to true concentration. You're initially carrying in your mind, as my experience of it, a sort of a picture of yourself sitting meditating, and because we have to carry that picture around in order to move through the world and to order the world. But when you're trying to concentrate your mind in the mindfulness of breathing, you try to drop that image of yourself, and come to a much, much more immediate experience of the sensations that make up breathing. So you're trying to move from a relatively highly constructed experience to a much more immediate experience. And that enables you to shift into a more whole state of mind. So I hope you can see how that relates to what you're saying, that where sensation is more mental, Vedana is more mental, you have more control over it because you have more power to adjust your interpretation. So you can be in acute physical pain and be experiencing intense dhyana, so I'm told. I can't say I've ever done it. But it's possible for your body to be sending signals of very great pain, whilst your mind is sort of experiencing a deep bliss even. Because the interpretive structure has changed, so that the sensations are right at the periphery.
And then to continue just to samskara and vijnana, so then the next step is how you act in relation to that you've got.
Yeah.
And then the final level is how the story you tell yourself about it.
That will be samya.
That's still samya.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, you can't make them sequential because they all happen together.
They all happen together.
It's a bundle. Vijnana, the best way to think of it probably is the containing framework. Because it's the moment of awareness within which all this takes place. So it's the assembler, right? I think in the Savastivada Abhidharma it's called Manasakara. Manaskara, which means literally mind maker. So it's what makes the mind into a complete, complex whole. In a way, going back to what you're saying, that the problem is that we're driven by our reactions to Vedana. As you put it, the flight and fight. It's of course more complex than that too. The problem is that we don't sufficiently understand what's happening. We don't even differentiate our Vedanas. We're not aware of them as something that's a resultant. It's completely mixed up with, identified with our reactions and responses. You can take emotion, for instance, a moment of emotion, a moment of anger. That moment of anger is a combination of all the different factors we've talked of. It's a sense of hurt, of pain, from what's been said to you, or what's been done to you, combined with a strong emotional reaction. But it all happens instantly. You hardly have a moment often to see the movement taking place from the Vedana to the reaction, to the emotion. Before you know it, not only are you feeling angry, you're doing anger, you're acting out of anger. It all happens so quickly. So what the Buddha says is the first thing in relation to Vedana, we need to be able to see it as it is. We need to see it arising, independence on various conditions, and we need to see that without those conditions it passes away. There's a wonderful story. Well, how are we doing for time? What's the... Maybe we'll stop there. I'll tell you the wonderful story and then I'll stop there. One of the Buddha's disciples said to him, I've realized there are 7 wonderful things about you. So the Buddha says, okay, give them to me. And he said, well, first of all, you were born from your mother when she was standing up. It's amazing, isn't it? As soon as you were born, you took 7 steps, and so on. They're all the sort of legendary stories about the Buddha's birth and his cosmic origins and so forth. So the Buddha says at the end of this account of 7 miraculous things, yep, those are all pretty good, but they're not the most important thing. Is the most miraculous thing about me is that when Vedanas arise, I know they're arising. When they remain, I know they're remaining. And when they pass, I know they're passing. That's the most miraculous thing about me. He goes on to say that when samnya, when interpretation arises, I know it's arising. When it stays, I know it's staying. When it passes, I know it's passing. And then when vitaka, when thought arises, I know it's arising, remaining and passing. So what he's saying is that it's miraculous to do this, but it's extremely important to be aware of vedanas as they arrive, to be aware of the hedonic tinge to your experience as it comes and goes, and to sort of observe it as a resultant, not as something which you have to take responsibility for in an immediate sense. To recognise it's something that's come to you as a result of the past, having a body of a particular kind, living in a particular circumstance and situation. Just to be aware of it, watching it pass. So that's the first point about pleasure. We need to be aware of it. It's the first point about pain, the first point about upeksha. So I hope that you've at least understood something from this. I hope that the bramble bushes that I fell into on the way won't deter you from continuing the ramble tomorrow, when we'll understand a little bit more about what we need to know about pleasure and pain in order to lead a successful spiritual life. But for now, what we need to know is what is happening, what vedanas are going on within us as they go on. We need to be conscious of them, and conscious of them in a sort of detached way. Not getting so caught up with them immediately that we rush into reaction, to flight or fight. You need to just observe them, experience them, welcome them, you might say, even, and determine our actions not simply in reaction to them. That's the first point. And I know I've taken a long time to say it, but that's what I wanted to say today. So tomorrow we'll look more at how we do that. Because in a way you could say, if you could do that, well, it would be equivalent to enlightenment. It would be equivalent to the mind of the Buddha. This is what is miraculous about the Buddha. He knows his vedanas as they come and go. But it's a counsel of perfection. Easier said than done. So we need to know more about vedana and how to work with vedana if we're able to get to that point at its fullest. Bus.
Thank you very much.